You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of April, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we talk with our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, who joins us to set the day's agenda from Tokyo. Kenji, what do you have for us today?
Today we've got three items. One is about Sejong, the 21st century capital that was supposed to replace Seoul, but isn't turning out that way.
That's all coming up in a little while. Plus, the German authorities launch a search for 50 former Auschwitz guards. We'll ask what the chances are that these men, who are now in their 90s, will ever come to trial.
And our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, walks us through what to expect from the special Monocle 24 broadcast from this week's 52nd annual Salone di Mobile in Milan.
Plus, we hear from a writer who was so sick of pitching stories to huffy editors, he set up the literary equivalent of an online dating agency.
What we wanted to do is take away all the payment stuff. So we pay the writer up front 50%. 50% comes after the article is published, so the writer can make a living off of it, and the editor just doesn't have anything to do with that anymore. He can deal with that later on, 6 months down the road when he's finished publishing. So we take care of all the payment stuff. You just concentrate on the words.
All that, plus we'll play some great music as well, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with David Spencer.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. South Korea says there are signs that North Korea is ready to fire a ballistic missile and to conduct another nuclear test. It says there has been movement at its atomic test site, similar to events preceding earlier blasts. The North's third nuclear test in February prompted tougher UN sanctions, which has triggered a hostile response from Pyongyang. Monocle 24's correspondent based in Seoul is Jason Strother. He's heading to one of the South Korean islands under threat from the North.
I'm going there to find out how people are coping with living under the barrel of North Korea's artillery. It was just a month ago that Kim Jong-un told soldiers on the North's west coast to, you know, take aim at Bangyang Island, that it would be considered a top military target. So I'm hoping to find out how people are coping under this type of stress.
One person's died in clashes in Cairo outside the city's main cathedral. The trouble followed the funerals of four Coptic Christians who were killed in religious violence on Thursday. Mourners leaving the cathedral clashed with local residents. The European Commission says Portugal must stick to targets agreed with international lenders if it wants more time to repay bailout loans. The country's constitutional court rejected 4 out of 9 contested austerity measures from this year's budget on Friday. Portugal, like Ireland, is seeking an extension to some of the EU loan deals, something that EU finance ministers will decide on later this week. Two bodies have been recovered from the wreckage of a light aircraft that crashed into the sea off the west coast of New Zealand's North Island last week. It's thought they are the CEO of New Zealand's mobile phone company, 2Degrees, Eric Hertz, and his wife, Kathy. The couple had been flying to Christchurch on their twin-engine Beechcraft when they reported engine problems. Lieutenant Commander Trevor Leslie's from the New Zealand Navy.
The task involved divers locating various parts of the wreckage, or the main parts of the wreckage, stropping them together and then attaching them to Manunui's crane.
Forensic experts in Chile will begin examining the body of Nobel Prize-winning poet Pablo Neruda today after carrying out an exhumation. The investigation follows claims by his former driver that he was poisoned under Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship. Neruda, famed for his passionate love poems and staunch communist views, was thought to have died from prostate cancer in 1973, 2 weeks after the military coup involving General Pinochet. Air India says it is preparing to fly its 6 Dreamliners in May after the final certification flight for a new battery system by Boeing. All the planes around the world were grounded because of 2 separate incidents earlier this year, identified as to do with the battery system. Boeing is now ready to file papers with the US Federal Aviation Administration in order for flights to resume. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. And David will be back in about 25 minutes with another check of the world news. It is 8:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And the time is just coming up to 16:06 in Tokyo, 8:06 a.m. here in London. We kickstart today's programme by setting the day's agenda, where we quite simply look through some of the stories that are featuring on our radar.
Kenji Hall, our Asia editor at large, joins us now on the line from our Tokyo bureau. What's on the agenda today, Kenji?
Well, first of all, as you heard on the top news, we're seeing signs, possible signs, that North Korea might be preparing for a fourth underground nuclear weapons test at a site where it performed its past three in 2006, 2009, and in this past February. So that's the first item. At this point, South Korean officials are not sure whether the North is actually preparing for an additional test or if it's just posturing to pressure Seoul and Washington to come to the table for talks. Interestingly enough, if you look around the region at the different reactions in Japan, Japanese Defense Minister Itsunori Onodera on Sunday ordered the self-defense forces to be ready to shoot down a North Korean ballistic missile. And in China, we saw Chinese Premier Xi Jinping sort of hinting that China was displeased with the North's rhetoric recently.
Kenji, we heard in the news our man in Seoul, Jason Strother, talking about the people coping with the stress in South Korea of this constant pressure from the North. And there's a very defiant top story in the Chosun Ilbo today of the Koreans picnicking and buying real estate, almost a sort of posturing towards the North. What is the general reaction from the press where you are in terms of all these constant threats that are coming from Pyongyang?
Well, I think the most recent threats have been a little more alarming than usual, simply because it's come amid sort of intensifying talk of war from North Korea. In Seoul, generally, people treat this thing with a grain of salt. They go on about their lives. They're used to this sort of steady drumbeat of threats from the North. So, you know, often you'll hear about these threats, and you'll see in South Korea folks more concerned about celebrity news or news about one of their own playing for the professional baseball leagues in the U.S. So it tends to be sort of a disconnect when viewing it from outside.
And Kenji, we heard yesterday that there were plans for a U.S. Missile test, an intercontinental ballistic missile test, to take place in the next coming days, but they've put that on hold because of these rising tensions. Do we have a sense of just how far the North is willing to go over this, or do we have any indication that they might be backing down at least somewhat?
No, at this point we don't, and I think that's why there's so much caution about this. As I mentioned earlier, China on Sunday expressed concern and what appeared to be sort of veiled criticism of its longtime ally. You don't see this very often. China is long seen as sort of the country that props up the regime in Pyongyang. And so when you see signs of frustration from Beijing, it means that possibly, you know, that things could be sort of heating up. Chinese officials at the same time, because they value stability above all else, you're unlikely to see them sort of pulling the plug on North Korea and taking away their support. And so at this point, you know, we'll just have to see how those developments occur.
And because of this astonishing position that China has as being possibly the only direct link into Pyongyang, which, you know, whether it's listened to or not is a different matter, how are the likes of Japan and Korea finding themselves having to turn to China to act almost as an intermediary?
At this point, I think what you're seeing is mostly the sort of diplomatic offensive coming from Washington. Washington is putting increasing pressure on China to act. You're not seeing much in the way of that sort of thing coming from Tokyo or Seoul. And if they're doing it, they're doing it quietly, behind the scenes, not sort of in the media limelight. So at this point, it's not clear to what extent Japan and South Korea are sort of pressing China to do more.
Well, John Kerry, Secretary of State in the U.S., is heading over to Asia. He's in the Middle East at the moment, but he will be visiting China as well as Seoul in the coming week, I believe. Do we know from analysts or from sources whether Kerry will be really pressuring the Chinese to back away from the North?
Well, it's interestingly asked because Washington has been pressing China to step up. We haven't seen the six-party talks. These are the talks that involve Japan, China, South Korea, the U.S., Russia, and North Korea. We haven't seen those take place for a couple of years now. And I think the feeling is that Beijing needs to put pressure on North Korea to get Pyongyang to re-enter those talks. Those are one of the few places where you have sort of a multilateral engagement with North Korea. The thinking is that once you do get North Korea to come to the table, they will sort of ease up on the rhetoric, ease up on sort of the warmongering, and possibly, you know, act more responsibly if that can actually happen.
Kenji, let's move on to a story of administrative overspill that isn't quite working. We have Seoul, which is being clogged up increasingly, and so they moved everything to Sejong. And it's what? It's the 100th day of the launch of the new complex in Sejong City, which is setting up an overspill for government offices, but it's not working, is it?
That's right. It's just about 3.5 months in since government ministries started moving to this new mini capital. It's about 150 kilometers south of Seoul. The first batch of government officials, there are about 5,000 of them, six government ministries. As you mentioned, it's to ease overcrowding in Seoul, where one in five South Koreans live. Seoul also wants to promote regional development. But at this point, there are problems with the move. Apartments are still under construction. Schools are at capacity. There are no hospitals or cinemas. You know, all of these things, including a sports stadium, hotels, department stores, they are in the plans. But at this point, you're not seeing any of that. And so I think among South Korean government officials, there's sort of an unwillingness to commit to Sejong just yet. At the same time, what you're seeing is that the prime minister, the vice prime minister, and other ministers and vice ministers are staying put for now. They need to stay near the Blue House, which is the executive office and the official residence of the president, and near the National Assembly. And what that's forcing other officials, other senior and sort of mid-level officials to do, is they're having to shuttle back and forth between Sejong and Seoul. It's not the most efficient way to run your government.
And Kenji, do we know what was in Sejong before this move? Was it just basically your typical provincial town in South Korea, or was there any other kind of government or corporate headquarters in the city?
No, it was mainly sort of a patch of peach farms, actually. And, you know, Seoul conceived this plan back in 2002. Actually, it was under former South Korean President Noh-myung, who proposed this as a campaign promise. His initial plan, which was very ambitious, has since been watered down. At the same time, it's still going to cost approximately 15 billion euros by the time it's finished, somewhere around 2030. When, you know, if all goes as planned, we'll see about 500,000 people living in Sejong. But at this point, it's still very much sort of a work in progress.
It is a work in progress, because I think when Brasilia was created for Brazil, there were very negative reactions, yet it seems to function quite satisfactorily now. Do you think this is a matter of time, that it needs to bed in, that better infrastructure needs to be put in place so that Sejong actually becomes the happy city that everybody wants it to be? Or is there just a fundamental problem with having everything out of Seoul?
Well, I think it's hard to tell at this point. I think having everything moved out of Seoul and having the ministry sort of scattered around South Korea is going to be quite difficult for, you know, ministers and ministry officials to actually conduct the business of running the government. At the same time, you know, the government has invested in a video conferencing system that cost millions of euros. And yet, you know, at this point, the park administration has yet to make a single video conference call. So they haven't quite used their resources as effectively as they can. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of shuttling between Sejong and Seoul. Apparently, the Ministry of Strategy and Finance estimates that by the end of this year, Its officials will have spent 88 million euros just on trips between Seoul and Sejong alone. So for now, some teething problems, but in the future, we may see a smoother process.
I guess it's good news, though, for bus and train companies. It's quite a bit of chunk of money there, 88 million euros. But moving from Korea to Japan, some more bad news at Fukushima's Daiichi nuclear power plant.
That's right. The most recent news is that there's a small amount of toxic water that's leaked from an underground storage pool at Fukushima nuclear power plant. That was the latest news on Sunday. The problem with that news is that it came 2 days after it was reported that a much larger leak from a similar storage pool had occurred. There are seven of these clay-lined storage pits at the plant. They're massive, 6 meters deep, 53 by 60 meters, and each is covered with protective waterproof lining that's supposed to prevent a leakage. But what we've seen is that in pool number two, which was the one that leaked on Friday, or the leak that we heard about on Friday at least, we saw 120 tons of highly radioactive water spilling from that pool. The second pool, which was actually pool number three, had a much smaller spillage. This calls into question whether the pools themselves can be trusted to keep the water in.
And as a result, what's been the reaction in Japan from this?
Well, I think there's a general sense that TEPCO, which is Tokyo Electric Power Company, isn't properly managing the process of shutting down these power plants. And that, it just goes to show that it's quite a messy business trying to get everything in order in Fukushima. We still hear reports of leakage into the sea. We still hear reports of fish being found containing highly radioactive particles. So I think it's still an ongoing process. Fukushima cannot be ignored.
Thanks very much, Kenji. That's Kenji Hall, our Asia editor-at-large. They're setting today's agenda. Coming up, we look at plans to investigate 50 alleged Auschwitz guards.
This week, the city of Milan will be awash with people talking about furniture. And Monocle 24 will be there too. It's the 52nd annual Salone del Mobile, the biggest trade show devoted to design in the world. Join me, Hugo MacDonald, as I bring you The Briefing, live from the heart of Milan from midday London time, from Monday to Wednesday this week. As I talk to guests from the many thousands of designers, architects, buyers and journalists pouring into the city. That's The Briefing, live from Milan at 1300 hours local time, Monday to Wednesday this week.
If you like Subways, not Subway sandwiches, if you want to know what makes a metropolis thrive or take a dive, and if you prefer the concrete jungle to the muddy field, then you need The Urbanist. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we explore the urban landscape by tram, subway and taxi to meet the people out to make urban life even better. In this episode of The Urbanist, we're looking at taxis.
You know, these black objects that hum and buzz around London, I mean, it's the lifeblood. If you think buses are arteries, well, we're the blood cells. We're the things that actually make things work and move.
In London, we'll find out why one black cab driver became obsessed by bollards. In Delhi, we discover why women have got their own cab service. And in San Francisco, drag queens too.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. Now, almost 70 years since the end of the Second World War, there are renewed efforts to bring those responsible for the war crimes committed between 1939 and 1945, and who are still alive, to justice. 50 former Auschwitz guards are to be the subject of fresh investigations by the German authorities, and if caught and brought to trial, those in the dock would be in their 90s.
It follows a legal precedent set by the trial of John Demjanjuk. He was convicted in 2011 for serving as a guard in Sobibor in Poland. He was released pending an appeal, but died last year in a nursing home. So what purpose do these renewed efforts to catch the guards serve? We're joined by Andrew Bulkley, who's a regular Monocle contributor based in Berlin. Well, Welcome, Andrew. Just explain to us the process that the German authorities are now engaged in to try and catch these men.
Well, traditionally, there's a one specific attorney, one prosecutor in southern Germany who goes after these guys. And traditionally, he's looked for witnesses that have survived that can pinpoint a specific crime on a former guard or a former soldier, and then he's convicted them of that specific crime. But after Demjanjuk, that changed because Demjanjuk was actually convicted for being part of the machinery of the camp in Sobibor that killed, it was 27,000 people, I believe. And that was the first time that a German court had convicted somebody just for being associated with a camp. And so it opened up a whole new door, and it's kind of like the legislation in America, and I think everywhere now, that prosecutors can pin specific crimes on an organization like the mafia or a gang, but not on a specific individual. So instead of convicting people for the crimes, they convict them for the crimes of the gang. And so that's what's changed this time, and that's why now they can finally go after guards of a specific camp.
And do we know who the specifics are of who's actually making this push to find these 50 or so alleged Auschwitz guards?
Sure we do. This is a guy, his name is Kurt Schrimm. He's a prosecutor at a special office. It's called the Central Office, the Zentrale Stelle, down in southern Germany. And what happened after the war was when they first started investigating these guys, everybody was trying it. States were trying it. The Allies were trying it. Israel was trying it. And things were getting kind of confusing. So at least within Germany, they centralized this down in Ludwigsburg, and this is one specific office that gathers all the intelligence, and then this one prosecutor and his staff then go after these people around the world and then prosecute them here in Germany. It's a guy named Kurt Schrimm.
Andrew, to what degree is this this latest campaign to bring the Auschwitz guards to justice a response to the fear that the next generation of Germany doesn't have any connection to the past and doesn't grasp what happened in its very recent history?
I don't think it's that. I think this is more, Kurt Schrimm has always been very dedicated to going after these guys and bringing these guys to justice in, I think, an ideological way that he believes in the law and justice, and also in a philosophical way that he's a German and feels that Germany has to pay for these crimes and specifically the people who committed these crimes. I think you can accuse Germany of, at times, probably being too lax in going after former guards or people who committed war crimes. They are probably guilty of that. But as a whole, if you come to Germany or Berlin, it's hard to avoid the war. I mean, I know the joke is, you know, don't mention the war, but you can't get away with not mentioning the war here. So the next generation of Germany and several generations to come, they're certainly not going to forget it. I think people are always just quick to point a finger at Germany that they're trying to hide their Nazi past. And at least some people within Germany, like Kurt Schrimm, are trying to say, no, we're not. And in fact, we are actively trying to clear up or do what's right, do the little bit we can do to make things right at this point. And that's certainly what he's doing.
And these 50 or so guards from Auschwitz, is there anything that we know about these individuals? Or is it likely that, you know, any one of these guards may potentially even hand themselves in? Is that even a likely prospect?
I don't know. They might hand themselves in just as any time you announce a major crime, a few people will then finally say, fine, you know, I'm tired of living with this, I'll turn myself in. These guys all supposedly live within Germany. He knows where each and every one of them lives. He says they're all about 90. So they will probably be prosecuted. It will turn into the usual. What happens when one of these guys gets found, you know, it's just this usual public debate about, you know, this guy has lived an upstanding life for the past 70 years, he's paid taxes, he has grandchildren, why are we prosecuting him now? And, you know, and it's always this poor, frail, old, hunched-over man gets wheeled into a courtroom, and for a second you think the same thing, but in the end, you know, their victims didn't have that right. Their victims never got to live an upstanding or even, you know, a bad life. They never got that chance, so it's about time that these guys get brought to justice. And there's this public debate, but ultimately this prosecutor is very black and white and wants to put these guys behind bars, and he always follows the cases all the way through. So, you know, a lot of them are going to die by the time they actually do get prosecuted, but I think probably all 50 names will show up at some point in a courtroom.
And that was Andrew Bulkley there in Berlin. Thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Von Out London. Dit is Monocle 24.
Where you London? This is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
The time here in London is 8:25 a.m., which means where we head now is 9:25, because Milan Salone del Mobile has had to undergo a refurb in the last few years. At its lowest point, it's sprawled flabbily from stand to stand, exhausting the legs and willpower of its visitors. The financial crisis caused the exhibition to go on somewhat of a diet in 2012. So how will this year, the 52nd Salone, shape up?
In addition to the thousands of designers, architects and journalists at the world's biggest design trade show, Monocle has dispatched our design editor Hugo McDonald plus producer Alid John. Monocle will be live in Milan on the briefing today, between today, Monday and Wednesday. And Hugo joins us now on the line. Hello, Hugo.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much. Well, we spoke when you were here on the show on Friday and you gave us a sneak peek of what we can expect. You're there in Milan now. What's the mood there on the ground?
Well, the mood is a bit drizzly, I'm afraid to say, on day one. We've all woken up to very grey skies, indeed, but it doesn't seem to be dampening people's spirits ahead of today, which is the sort of preview day for the press and the designers. It's always quite a funny day because, as with most things in Italy, everything's running behind and lots of people charging down streets with various armfuls of wood and nail guns and things, putting the last finishing touches to their exhibitions and shows as everybody stands outside waiting to get in.
When we've spoken about this before, Hugo, you've expressed, I think that would be fair to say, your dismay at the way that the Salone used to be run. And I remember last year you were very hopeful that things were trimming down, they were getting neater, the flab, the sort of the sideshows of the Salone were being pushed out of the way and people could concentrate on design. Is there that feeling that this year?
Well, there is. Exactly like you say, over the last 3 or 4 years, just been a bit frustrated that there's so much posturing that such the design industry is fine and we haven't been affected by the recession, which is, of course, nonsense. It just seems that it took a little bit longer to hit. This year, by the looks of things, everything has been consolidated quite neatly. I mentioned on the show on Friday that a lot of people have been collaborating, sharing the expense of, you know, rather than having 10 exhibitions grouping together and showing in one space, rather than showing 20 new pieces of furniture, being quite honest and saying, well, you know, there just simply isn't the funds to do a show like that anymore. We'll just put all our energy and money into showing one really great piece. So things seem to be a little bit more honest this year. And that said, I haven't actually seen anything yet. And on my way to my first meeting, which I myself am running a little bit late for.
Is that our fault, Hugo?
No, it's not at all. It's a mixture of the rain and then having a little difficulty getting a taxi. the show continues to come over the rest of the week. Generally, the mood in advance of something starting is that it will be a trend down. So fair, but much better for it, in my opinion.
Hugo, it sounds like you're rushing to get to where you need to. I think we're losing you on the mobile. Would you be kind enough to stand still for just a moment while we finish our conversation? I'm so sorry to ask you to do that.
No, that's fine. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. We can hear you now perfectly.
And Hugo, just to have you there, you will be hosting some very special broadcasts of the briefing today at midday. Give us a sense of what we can expect on some of those shows.
Yes, well, today we are hosting it from the Museum of Science and Technology, which is one of these hub areas that comes alive during the city. We have a host of amazing guests, including Ambra Medder, who is the founder of Design Miami, another great design trade show over in Miami. We have a fantastic giant in the advertising industry, Luca Liberale, who's going to come on and talk about the importance of supporting the small producers who really kick-started modern design in Italy. And people seem to be sort of overlooking their importance today in a much more globalized design industry. I could go on, but I don't want to give away too much. You can tune in at midday London time or 1300 hours CET to hear what we have in store.
Just finally, Hugo, you mentioned there that the small producers, who you say aren't being given enough breathing space to expand. There's that idea, the good Italy, bad Italy, that's currently doing the rounds, that the bad Italy is the corruption and the good Italy is the enterprising spirit that has been dampened down for the last couple of decades. Talking in anticipation of the way that the Salone is going to go this year, do you get the feeling that good Italy might win?
I do, definitely. I mean, Salone of old has always been about the good side of Italy. And like you say, this entrepreneurial, enterprising spirit, the makers in their studios this country is famous for. And by the looks of things, that is really being pushed to the front all over again. It's less about the number of sofas they were selling in China and much more about celebrating just the raw skill and talent that kick-started modern design. And here in Italy and here in Milan is really where it started.
Hugo MacDonald, Monocle's design editor, clearly in a rush to get to his first meeting at the Italian lighting firm Artemide. He's on his way. Hugo, you may start running now. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. And just to remind everybody, the briefing Monday to Wednesday this week will be coming live from the Salone del Mobile in Milan. That's at midday London time.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires,
to Hong Kong,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour of the programme, our woman in Pakistan, Samira Shackle, a look at the international front pages with our Alexandra de Kramer, and we'll meet the man who brings publishers and writers together.
What we wanted to do is take away all the payment stuff. So we pay the writer up front 50%. 50% comes after the article is published. So the writer can make a living off of it. And the editor just doesn't have anything to do with that anymore. He can deal with that later on, 6 months down the road when he's finished publishing. So we take care of all the payment stuff. You just concentrate on the words.
And we'll have a bit more from Kabir Chieber in just a few moments. But first, the time is 8:31 here in London. Here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. South Korea says there are indications that North Korea is ready to carry out a fourth nuclear test. The North's third test in February prompted tougher UN sanctions, which triggered a hostile response from Pyongyang. One person's died in clashes in Cairo outside the city's main cathedral. The trouble followed the funerals of four Christians who were killed in religious violence on Thursday. The European Commission says Portugal must stick to targets agreed with international lenders if it wants more time to repay bailout loans. Portugal, like Ireland, is seeking an extension to some of the EU loan deals, something that EU finance ministers will decide on Friday. Two bodies have been recovered from the wreckage of a light aircraft that crashed into the sea off the west coast of New Zealand's North Island last week. It's thought they are the CEO of New Zealand's mobile phone company 2Degrees, Eric Hertz, and his wife. Forensic experts in Chile will begin examining the body of Nobel Prize-winning poet Pablo Neruda today after his body was exhumed. The investigation follows claims by his former driver that he was poisoned under Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David, and we will see you back in about 27 minutes here with another check of the world news. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson.
And the time here in London is 8:33 a.m. Now, this week on Culture, we'll be entertained by an upbeat session from New Orleans' Hot 8 brass band. We'll head over to Dublin to meet the man who's made an award-winning and very charming filmic portrait of Irish farming, and we'll have a report from SP Arte, South America's best art fair. But in this preview, we'll meet a freelance writer and editor who always found it a pain getting his pitches read, commissioned, and most importantly, paid for.
Well, so many good ideas to go to waste because there's no central place for them to be seen and heard, he seems to be saying. So he set up a website, pitchme.org, that puts journalists and publishers in touch so that the dog can see the bone and vice versa. It's an ideas shop, a story bank. His name is Kabir Chieber, and he pops by Midori House to chat to culture host Robert Bound.
Pitch Me is a one-stop shop for ideas, basically. It's a marketplace for stories. So writers can come on, they can pitch their stories there. So you have a listings of all the pitches that are there. Editors can come to the site and buy them. And it's really that simple. So
presumably you have to subscribe to it. You have to presumably pay. If you're me, if you're an editor at a magazine, you have to pay to use the service. This is how you guys make some money, right?
In the initial stages, we're still working on things now. So if you're a writer, you come on and it's a request, an invite. So if we approve you, you can come on the site and you can use it and you pay a small fee plus a percentage, something in the order of $15 or £12 plus 3% of your fee. If you're a subscriber, in terms of an editor, that's working on a different basis at the moment. So we're looking at subscription model, we're looking at other models as well. But yes, eventually at some point there'll be some mix of the two.
And is it sort of based more for freelance writers? Did the genesis of it come from being maybe a frustrated freelance writer or an ambitious one, or from being an editor? Because I think you're a little bit of both, right?
I am a bit of both, yes. I've been a writer for the New York Times and Harper's and various other magazines, Esquire and things like that, for a few years now. And it's extremely frustrating experience. You know, you pitch to editors, it takes ages to get paid, it takes ages to get expenses cleared, and then your editor gets fired and you have to start all over again, or you move and you have to start all over again. And I've also commissioned writers, and I found it to be a really frustrating process to get writers to kind of do the things that you want them to do, or to find the quality of writers that you wanted. So it was kind of a solution to a lot of problems. And I was having a particularly bad experience with an article last year, having things paid for it, and it just was ridiculous. I thought there has to be a better way, and it sort of, this idea came to me, and I've been working on it ever since.
Because there's also, as you're alluding to there, there is a as part of Pitch Me, part of the deal is about getting paid, isn't it, and making that easier, that process easier. I know that I know what it's like. I sat next to the managing editor here at Monocle, for example, and he has to take a lot of phone calls and juggle a lot of kind of expenses claims and, as you say, and invoices from people.
And there's a lot of email tennis as well, just back and
forth. It's a lot of stuff, yeah. Everyone's sort of trying to put everyone else off at the same time.
I think what I find is that, or what I found is that you spend all your time wanting to write something really, really cool, but you spend all your actual time dealing with all this crap, so to speak, expenses, all these payments, chasing things up, and you can't make a living off of it. I think that was what I found to be the most annoying thing. So you have a rent payment due at whenever you have it due, and your payment's not going to come for another 3 months for arbitrary reasons. And so what we wanted to do is take away all the payment stuff. So we pay the writer up front 50%. 50% comes after the article is published, so the writer can make a living off of it, and the editor is just doesn't have anything to do with that anymore. He can deal with that later on, 6 months down the road when he's finished publishing. So we take care of all the payment stuff. You just concentrate on the words.
So magazines, newspapers, radio stations, TV stations, mm-hmm. whatever it might be, who are commissioning writers through Pitch Me, do they kind of have a contract with you then? The onus is kind of between you and them.
I think it's a sort of two-way contract. When you negotiate with your, if you're an editor and you negotiate with your writer, you negotiate exactly how you want the contract to be. It sort of changes live on the page in a kind of cool fashion. So, for example, one of the people we have on the site is the Atavist, who are these lovely long-form storytellers from New York, and they don't pay people at all. They do everything in terms of royalties. So they can get rid of everything and just be, you know, we'll pay you 50% royalties after a certain amount of time. You know, you can agree that kind of thing. So what happens is the writer and the editor agree the contract. They do all that kind of stuff. They're happy with that. And as part of the using Pitch Me service, we take care of that. So whatever you agree on, we pay 50% up front, 50% there. So we take care of all the payment system. We deal with the editor through the back end. And we try and make it so neither side actually has to worry about that. You just negotiate the fee and the fee is taken care of.
So I'm a writer. I've got this fantastic story about God knows what. Uh-huh. Maybe it's difficult to get a story about the intricacies of cricket into Monocle magazine, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I've tried this before. Or I want to get it anywhere. I want to get it published by someone decent, clearly, and get paid okay for it. What do I do? What's the process for me pitching my stories, uploading it onto your website? How does it work?
At the moment now, you'd have to request an invite and give a little bit of a bio to yourself. So we take a look and we'd see that you're the kind of writer that would benefit from the system. And that's not to be cruel to writers or to get rid of people. It's just that I think at this initial stage, you know, we have several hundred writers on and we're running at something quite insane recently, you know, 50 invite requests a day. And so we don't want to have people out there who won't get the full benefit of the service. So first of all, you'd have to do that. Once you sign up, you'd put all your details in there, you know, who you've worked for in the past. There's a couple of cool things that are on there that kind of form part of your profile, like, you know, what's the favorite piece you've ever written? And what's your dream piece? Because every writer has dream pieces, what they really want to do, not the kind of stuff they want to do. So you might be the, you know, culture editor of Monocle and you love it, but really what you want to do is write about cricket all the time, all day long, 24 hours a day, write about cricket. So that might be your dream. And so you can write that. And so if a cricket editor or a sports editor of another newspaper sees that, they'll say, oh, what he really wants to do is write about cricket. He's passionate about the project. Then you just simply go to a section called Create Your Pitch. You'd put all your ideas in there. You'd put in a headline. You'd put in a word count. You'd put in a rough fee, which is the start of negotiation. You put in your pitch and that's it. And one other thing to add is that some writers were concerned about their ideas being stolen, which we don't think is a particularly big deal.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That's because it's a kind of open forum, isn't it?
It is an open forum. What we do to prevent that is, one, of course, we know who's on the site. So in a certain sense, as a moot point, if you see something there, it's clearly theft. But if you're a writer and you go on the site, you can only look at the synopsis of things. So only editors, which we call publishers and pitchers are the two people on the site. Only publishers can look on the site and see the full proposal with the full word count, with the full thing. So everybody else can just sort of see a headline and a few lines to get them going. And that's proving to be quite useful at the moment because writers are liking each other's. So our page, our front page is based on popularity. So writers are liking each other's works and publishers are liking each other's the works that they see. And that pushes things up and down the front page, which is coming to a really nice, interesting mix of, you know, China and Congo.
Right. So your front page is almost like a front page.
Exactly.
It's the best or the most important stories.
Absolutely. And very soon there will be a sort of ticker on there as well. So we're going to start mimicking a lot of the functionality that, you know, writers and editors are used to. So you'll have a ticker there saying a piece was sold. You know, there's a writer and editor talking as we speak, and they'll hopefully sign something by today or tomorrow. So it'll be there, you know, new sale today. 4 new pitches on the site today. We've had 8 pitches in the last 3 days or so, but there's not that many forms for us to tell people about that.
As overseeing the site, you must be excited. We won't go into maybe specific stories. I don't know that we can do that, but you must be excited about some of the stuff that's gone up there and thought, God, when I was writing and when you were editing, that these are things you'd love to have commissioned.
Absolutely.
I guess you still can.
I still can commission, yeah. And I think that's one of the beauties of it. And I pitch. There's, you know, if you look on the site, you'll see some of my ideas on there, stuff that I really wanted to tell. Some things are really esoteric. One actually is about cricket, and another one.
We're both going to get a job here, aren't we?
Hopefully, yes. Yeah, I think
that's what we're doing.
So we'll start Cricket Monthly, basically, and just commission writers to pitch me.
This show's big in Australia, right here. It's going to be fine. We're going to emigrate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the weather will hopefully be better than here.
Yes, exactly.
It hasn't improved, I can tell you, since Robert and Kabir Chibber did that interview a couple of days ago. That was Kabir Chibber speaking to Robert Band for today's edition of Culture, which you can catch at 1900 hours London time. And just to have a look, the website that Kabir was talking about is pitchme.org, and I'm having a look at it now.
And you're listening to Mandori House. We'll be back after this with news from Pakistan.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan. Turning the Tide on Monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. And the time is for us to check now in Pakistan, where we head for a roundup of the headlines on the ground there.
Samira Shackle is our woman, and she is on the line. Welcome to the show, Samira. News that's been dominating the headlines this weekend, at least, is the fact that Pervez Musharraf has managed to find somewhere which will accept him as a candidate in the upcoming elections. Is everybody surprised by that, or was this just inevitable?
I think actually people were quite surprised that he was barred from standing in the main constituencies. So he's been barred from standing in Karachi, the country's economic hub, and from standing in Islamabad, the country's capital. And he's now been accepted in a slightly unknown seat in Chitral, which is in the far north of the country. And, you know, there's been some speculation, is he going to stand at all? Is it going to be embarrassing for him to stand on this sort of slightly obscure seat? But it seems like he's going to go ahead. I think the surprise was definitely at the suggestion that he might be banned from standing altogether.
And Musharraf returned to Pakistan on March 24th after being in exile in Dubai. We've already seen him have a shoe thrown at him. But what's the general mood, the mood been there for Musharraf and his return?
I think the general sense is that he's a bit of a sideshow in the election. I mean, no one really sees him sort of sweeping the electorate off their feet and coming into power again. I think he's got a sort of small and committed band of followers. It's slightly growing because I think people say, look, look at what we've had in the last 5 years. At least he was honest financially, and at least the country was growing economically. But I don't think... he's not really the main attraction in the election. I mean, it's an interesting story. People are quite bemused by it. I mean, there's not really any historical precedent for a former military dictator trying to then returning to a country and seeking power through the ballot box. So I think it's interesting from that respect. But no one sees him as a sort of serious contender for the presidency or prime ministership.
It is interesting, isn't it, Samira, because these elections will be the first transition between two democratically elected governments in the history of Pakistan. And as you say, Musharraf is the man who seizes power via a coup. Is there any sense that there's any willingness to go back to that kind of life? Or are people now so happy to have, well, not happy, but are now used to the idea of democratic transition?
I think everyone has a big stake in the idea of democratic transition, and I think there's definitely a sense that people almost can't quite believe that it's going to happen. I mean, it's quite common to hear people speculating that the election is still going to be delayed, that the current caretaker setup is going to stay in power for the next 2 or 3 years. So I think people are still very nervous about the idea of a power grab, but the general consensus is that people are very happy the election's happening, that it's going to be a big step forward for the country. And I mean, there was a poll, I think it was last week, that showed that a lot of the country's youth actually favoured military rule, because I think just because things were running better, and it's been quite a tough few years in Pakistan. But I would say, across the population, I mean, everyone I speak to, is there's a real sense that this is a historic moment, and that, you know, there's a lot to be improved upon, but if this election goes ahead, it's going to create a much stronger mandate for civilian governments in the future to build upon.
And you say that these elections can be they will be a historic moment. Some news out of the tribal areas of Waziristan, two women who are going to be standing for election.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's a huge symbolic value, that. So the Waziristan is the most conservative area of the country. It's the part that borders Afghanistan. It's federally administered tribal area, so it's not directly under the jurisdiction of the Pakistani state. It's completely torn by conflict, Taliban militancy, Pakistani military's counterinsurgency operations there, and women, for the most part, can't even leave the house. I mean, with their husband maybe, but sometimes not at all. You've got very, very low representation of women in the electorate there, because often they're not registered for ID cards, or they're not allowed to go to polling stations. And yet you have these two women who are both, one's illiterate, one's sort of semi-literate, putting themselves forward to stand in the elections. And it's really quite striking bravery, especially when you consider that in 2008, in the last election, the Taliban issued death threats for women just going to vote, let alone standing.
It is one of those situations that you really do admire these women, yet you do sort of question whether, you know, why they're doing it. Is there any kind of was there any impetus given by the survival and the sort of sheer bloody mindedness of the likes of Malala Yousafzai, who obviously survived an attack by the Taliban and perhaps has become this symbol for sort of freedom of expression?
Yeah, I think to an extent. But I think perhaps less than people doing things because of Malala. I think she was a good example of the sheer resilience of a lot of women in these areas. And in fact, the area where these women are standing is far more conservative than the area Malala came from, and far more volatile. So it is striking bravery, and I'm sure that helps. And I think seeing the positive response to Malala, both domestically and internationally, I'm sure has given these women it's a sort of greater self-confidence. And I think also just the presence of, there's been all-female quotas in Parliament in place for the last decade or so, and I think that's made a big difference on women's aspirations. Just thinking, well, you know, it's an option. I don't have to completely stay out of the public arena.
That was Samira Shackle there, Monocle's woman in Pakistan, with a check of some election news out of the country. Thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House.
London. New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is fast approaching 49 minutes past the hour. In a moment, we review Monday's Turkish front pages to set us on the right vibe. This is the Turkish hit singer Murat Dalkilic with Yudum Yudum. Murat Dalkalic there from Turkey. More about whom in just a moment's time. And that track was called Yudum Yudum, Sip by Sip, apparently.
And I just want to say, for the record, that there was some very uncomfortable dancing.
There was some mummy dancing going on there. And in the control room, I daren't describe what was happening, but there was an expression of sheer love for this song by our producer, Marcus Hippie.
And and we're also joined by Monocle's resident Turkish journalist, our researcher Alexandra de Kramer here in the studio. Are you a fan?
Hello. Yeah, kind of.
He's That's very not like... what you said 5 minutes ago.
I like him, but he's not my favorite. And he's like the new age Tarkan.
And he's from your hometown,
yes,
isn't he?
Yes, he's from Izmir. And like that's where he became famous as well. Like when he was 15, he had a band and then began with singing in bars and stuff. And then moved to Istanbul.
Now, we only know him for Yudum Yudum, which obviously Marcus Hippie creates a tiny little Finnish disco for. what's the rest of his music like? Or is it all sort of sunny summer kind of stuff?
It's exactly. It's like very... No, I wouldn't say pop, exciting, upbeat.
What a joy. Alexandra joins us in the studio, ladies and gentlemen, to have a look at today's Turkish papers. Sadly, well, luckily for Alexandra, she's the only person in the room who speaks Turkish. So we're
I can understand the pictures.
Pictures.
Yeah. We understand the pictures.
You want to start? We'll move on to the pictures later because they're frankly brilliant and I have no idea why. But there is obviously a large amount of coverage at the moment of John Kerry, US Secretary of State, and his quite astonishing announcement that he wanted Turkey to play this key role in trying to get the Israelis and the Palestinians to come to some sort of peace agreement, which has left everybody scratching their heads.
Yeah, so Kerry visited for the second time Istanbul to speak with Prime Minister Erdogan and Foreign Minister Davutoğlu, and he met them in Dolmabahçe, sorry, in Istanbul for a 2-hour-long talk. Basically, obviously the Middle East was on the table and the US wants kind of Turkey to mediate between Israel and Hamas. I don't know how this will be approached by the government, but I don't think they would want to. I believe that they won't be able to mediate a peace. But I think that's like the biggest thing on Kerry's agenda at the moment, like to solve the Middle East peace. I think he wants to go through Israel and...
And the Israelis have already dismissed the talks by Turkey playing a role, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. They said like Israel and Turkey just have literally last week reconvened their relationship, rejuvenated it, and I don't think this is healthy. I don't think that, and we as Israelis can speak to the Palestinians ourselves, and we don't need anyone else to kind of help us speak to each other.
Is this in any way connected to this apology that Bibi Netanyahu gave to Prime Minister Erdogan a couple of weeks ago to do with the flotilla killings? To what degree do you think Turkey is now going to be slightly responsive to anything from Jerusalem? Because Prime Minister Erdogan in the past has not necessarily trod a very diplomatic path when it comes to Israel.
True, but let's not forget that Turkey is the first country to recognize Israel. We have had really good relationships until the flotilla incident, because especially Erdogan's government is politically siding with Palestinians, and not in terms of choosing Israel over Palestinians, just making clear that they believe the Palestinians need help and Turkey can help them, and for that reason. We have had lots of criticism from Israel. I think it will still take time for them to kind of be on speaking terms. It was just last week. I don't think we have any power to be convincing the Palestinians or Israelis to come together. But it's a step.
And from the Milliyet, we head now to the Hurriyet daily, which is just as colorful as the other their counterparts. What story do you has caught your attention here?
There was an interesting interview that's like one of the biggest stories on the front cover with Adnan Durak, who is the chief village ranger in Tepealtı, which is located in Mardin. So this is following up with the Kurdish Turkish peace process, and basically the rangers are saying that Turkish soldiers will be forgiven if we are moved forward with the peace process, but I don't think the rangers will. So it's just an interesting side that they are unwilling, because the government has asked both sides, like Turks and Kurds, to leave their guns, and they're just saying that they're really scared and they won't be able to leave their guns.
Alex, we have about 10 seconds. What does that picture say? There's a man who looks incredibly surprised by a very big book on the front cover of Hurriyet.
Yeah, I think he's like looking into Ottoman documents and just saying the westernization in Turkey is not a problem. It has been here for ages.
Look it up, ladies.
Umberto Eco.
It's Umberto Eco.
Yeah.
Of course it's Umberto Eco. Umberto Eco is basically looking at a book that is huge and it looks like it was tiny a moment ago, but has now exploded. Alexandra de Kramer, thank you very much indeed
for
joining us in the studio. That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producers, Marcus Hippie and Alan John, our researcher, Alexandra de Kramer, and of course, newspaper guest, and Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is the latest edition of The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Phil will be joined by Dom Reynolds. They'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Phil Hahn. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.